Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. You may visit us online at http://kosherscene.wordpress.com. This past Wednesday, the Kosher Scene did a live radio broadcast once again from Nargila Grill at 1599 York Avenue between 84th and 85th in Manhattan's Upper East Side. As we were plagued by some difficult technical problems, we are doing now a makeup broadcast at this hour. The occasion of our revisit to Nargila was the owner's mother's monthly appearance to cook authentic Bukharian cuisine. Turned out the actual chef at this time was the owner Michael's uncle, who authored a book on Jewish Bukharian cooking. We started our meal with various mild and spicy salads and then were served a dish of ashpalov, a distinctive, delicious, naturally sweetened rice with carrots and succulent pieces of beef stew. It was a perfect opportunity to discuss Jewish cuisine as a culture that evolves with the times while its key elements remain the same. Present with me were, in alphabetical order, Alessandra Rovatti from dinnerinvenice.com, Gila Hockerman, author of the upcoming The Kosher Revolution, Tim Amzalag from Kosher Inspired and Mishpacha Magazines, Levana Kirschenbaum from levanacooks.com, the author of 4 cookbooks, including the brand new The Whole Foods Kosher Kitchen, Marlene Mami, thekosherhostess.com, and Shoshana Raff from koshershopaholic.com. Gil Marx, in his Encyclopedia of Jewish Foods, writes, "Food is more than just sustenance. It is a reflection of the history, culture, and values, and this is especially true of the Jewish people, a community that spans the globe. From Brooklyn to India and everywhere in between, Jewish food is represented by a fascinating array of dishes, rituals, and traditions. Jewish cuisine is truly international. In every location Jews settled, they brought culinary traditions and also adapted local dishes, modifying them to fit their dietary laws, lifestyles, and tastes. Unique traditions and dishes were developed within the cuisines of North Africa, Europe, Persia, and the Mediterranean, but all, every single one, are recognizably Jewish." Unquote. Food appears everywhere in Jewish culture. It had always been an important part of our traditions. In the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, after Hashem creates Adam, he plants the Garden of Eden, places Adam in it, and carefully instructs him, "Umeitz adat tov v'ra lo tochal mimeno, ki beyom ochalcha mimeno mot tamut. But of the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for on the day you eat of it, you will surely die." Breishit Bet Yitzayin, Genesis 2, verse 17. This is the very first indication that there are some foods that one can eat and others one must not. Soon, this will extend to become a more generic principle where there will always be some limits put upon human behavior. We already know that it was through food, through violating the very first command that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to the newly created human, that Adam and Eve fell from the high rung they were meant to stand at. They tasted from the Eitz HaDaat, and they lost their beautiful innocence and learned shame, while Adam immediately started the blame game, throwing in the Borei Olam's face the splendid gift the Almighty had just given him, namely Eve. Yes, food was the source of the first couple's loss of innocence and of the first known strife. And yet, without food we cannot subsist. Food, therefore, represents both the sustainment of life and the source of evil. How are we to understand this strange paradox? How are we to navigate, to balance both aspects and still lead a healthy, fruitful existence? As we became confirmed carnivores in later stages of our history, the laws of Kashrut were eventually given, further elucidating what we may and may not put into our mouth and guiding us to a healthy, happy, fulfilled Jewish life. Historically, food had always meant more than what we consume for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Food has always had a religious, medicinal, or spiritual significance. Certain herbs, fruits, etc., were considered necessary or at least contributory to staying healthy. Certain foods consumed at specific times had the power to enhance our awareness of the world around us and to reinforce the connection to our past. The blessings that we pronounce upon that which enters our mouth have the power to bring us closer to an understanding of our task on this lowly plane of existence. Food, in other words, is not only essential for us as humans, but a strict adherence to our dietary laws is integral to our continued life as Jews. An outsider might infer from the above, therefore, that the Jewish diet must be rigid and boring, yet nothing could be further from the truth. As Alessandra Rovati of the Black Dinner in Venice tells us, Jewish Italian cooking was considered the jewel of Italian cuisine. Jews started arriving in the Italian peninsula during the Roman Empire's heyday, as attested to this day by the Roman ghetto in Lungotevericenci, right next to the ruins of the Roman Forum and within walking distance of the Colosseum. They came from all over the Mediterranean basin and brought with them the traditions they cultivated throughout the various regions. As they adapted and combined their food customs with what was available locally, they developed and greatly enhanced Italian cuisine. Marlene Mami of the Jewish Hostess blog shows that presentation is very important in Syrian Jewish cuisine, taking into account the local topography and environment's impact on the availability of food in any given season. The Syrian Jewish hostess always strove to present her culinary creations in the most attractive manner possible within her means, in honor of Shabbat and the holy days. It is obvious this Jewish hostess fully understood long, long ago what 19th century French politician and gastronome extraordinaire Jean-Barthélemy Briat-Savarin, in his Physiologie du goût, the physiology of taste, teaches that it is in the eye and the nose, that it is the eye and the nose that will entice us to or chase us away from partaking a particular dish, while the actual taste plays a very secondary role, at least the first time we consume it. Times change, and as we understand that certain methods of preparation are not as healthy, we continue to adapt and evolve, and in many cases, we go back to the old natural ways of preparing things, albeit in new variations and combinations that only enhance our eating experience, as evidenced by Levana Kirschenbaum's brand new The Whole Foods Kosher Kitchen. She shows us that without starving ourselves, by merely changing our eating habits, we can lose weight, we can restore our health, and we can keep ourselves young and energetic far longer. As Susanna Ruff from the Kosher Shopaholic observed, it is remarkable how, in spite of the different foods available throughout the various lands of our exile, in spite of often very different traditions, so much of the basic Jewish cuisine is similar, regardless of what country or region Jews reside in. Tim Amzalag of Kosher-inspired Mishpacha magazine commented on the beautiful mosaic of Jews and foods of different origins, on the plethora of customs varying between various parts of the world, and how this seemingly disparate amalgam was all unmistakably, recognizably Jewish. Nargila Grill's owner's mother explained to us that the Bukharian cuisine is vaguely similar to Persian because of a somewhat shared topology and climate, and because of certain similarities between the Bukharians and the Persians in their customs and even in the languages. In my own research, I also found that they have a lot in common with the Uzbeki cuisine, which I've extolled in my own blog at kosherscene.wordpress.com. When I asked Dila Hackerman, author of the upcoming Kosher Revolution, which will be on the shelves this August, if she agreed with a statement on her kosherrevolution.com website to the effect that, quote, kosher is a set of rules, not a cuisine, unquote, she answered that those were not her words, but strictly the words of Arthur Schwartz. When asked to elaborate, she explained that in today's day and age, when communications, travel, and technology in general have considerably shrunk our planet, and we are now exposed to various exotic cuisines as never before, when the average Jew is no longer confined to his village and immediate surroundings, kosher cuisine is suddenly far more encompassing, far more a part of the global village, though it still retains its uniquely Jewish character. To me, the art of cooking is no less an art than literature at its finest. Just like every country has its classics, new and old, like Spain's Cervantes or Lope de Vega, England's Shakespeare or Marlowe, France's Rabelais, Alexandre Dumas or Alfred de Musset, Russia's Tolstoy, Gorky or Solzhenitsyn, Italy's Dante, Torquato Tasso or Italo Calvino, and so on, every cuisine has its unique creators. These creators display the same degree of imagination, the same understanding of their media as writers, as painters, the same sensitivity to the subtle nuances of their instruments, ingredients in this case, as the greatest, most celebrated composers. Yet, though these works of art have a very short lifespan, and more often than not, the creator's name is long forgotten, a great culinary creation will endure through the ages, imitated and sometimes improved to accommodate our evolving tastes. Through it all, one can always tell, just like in the case of changing fashion, if overall times are affluent or depressed. Food, more often than not, is a barometer of the times. As Gil Marx tells it, European Ashkenazim, unlike their Sephardi brothers, for many centuries shied away from vegetables. Many rabbinic responsa were written decrying the use of vegetables as unhealthy. In fact, tomatoes were described as treifene apple, unkosher apples. Then, in the middle of the 19th century, a famine spread through Eastern Europe, and the already impoverished Jewish masses desperately needed to find a new diet. And so, the traditional meat-based Shabbat Pashtida, dating all the way to Mishnaic times, was supplanted by Kugel and Cholent. An Ashkenazi Jewry suddenly discovered what Sephardim in the Mediterranean basin had known all along. There was nothing unhealthy or unkosher about vegetables. Quite the contrary. Eastern European Cholent evolved because Jews needed something that could cook slowly on Shabbat and without burning. Some food that was filling yet inexpensive. The same criteria was instrumental in developing the similar dafina, chaminado, or chamin. Though there were no telephones, no internet, though there were no planes, no cars, and travel by sea was perilous and took very long, Jews throughout the lands of their dispersion, often without any communication, came up with similar dishes because our dietary laws, our traditions, dictated it. As for the question as to whether there is a distinct Jewish cuisine, while we have adapted and refined other people's cooking, the answer is a resounding yes. Many a secular Jew recalls with affection the aromas and the tastes of traditional foods, various holidays in his or her younger years. And while they are trying their best to integrate into the regular population and adapt their customs, just like Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf, who was always strongly anti-bourgeois, but couldn't fully divorce himself from his bourgeois comforts, neither can they, the secular Jews, last without the occasional traditional Jewish food that fuels their nostalgia for a past they publicly pretend to disavow. Jewish communist writers murdered by Stalin, like David Bergelson, Isaac Babel, and others, may have intended their message to be universal, but chose Jewish characters to convey their art. Ultimate opportunist, absolute survivor throughout the worst of Stalinist and subsequent Russian regimes, Ilya Ehrenburg, a firm atheist, could not help himself in bringing in a Jewish character or two in his Adventures of Julio Jurenito and His Disciples, or in The Stormy Life of Lassie Kreutzfant. These writers had long tried to separate themselves from their Jewish roots and adapt instead a universalism that made them undistinguishable from anybody else. Yet they couldn't. Just like they failed at this task, and willingly or not, remained easily identifiable Jews, so it is that whether we consume Chinese, Thai, Japanese, Libyan, or any other cuisine, as long as it complies with the laws of Kashrut, it has willingly or unwillingly been transformed into Jewish cuisine. Ilya Ehrenburg, in his memoir, in speaking about his oft-changing public stances and sycophantic praise of Stalin while the latter was alive, says, quote, "If within a lifetime a man changes his skin an infinite number of times, almost as often as his suit, he still does not change his heart, because he has but one. Food, once it complies with Jewish dietary law, regardless of how many times the ingredients were and will still be amended, and as long as it stays within the prescribed parameters, will forever be Jewish food, regardless of origin, and the one who eats it will never quite manage to fully extinguish the tiny little Jewish flame, forever burning and warning his or her heart. Whether I taste couscous, cholent, dafina, kibbe, lahamejin, brisket, mugine in bianco, carciofi alla giudia, antipasti, pirogis, kreplach, mamaliga, goulash or holoches, I am essentially partaking of nothing more and nothing less than the rich diversity of Jewish cuisine." Briat Savarin once wrote, "The destiny of nations depends on how they are fed," unquote. How true, gentle listener. Once again, we want to thank Nargila Grill for the delicious food and invite you to visit them at 1599 York Avenue between 84th and 85th Street in Manhattan's Upper East Side. Their moderate prices will truly amaze you. This is Chaim Schmidt from The Kosher Scene at http://kosherscene.wordpress.com. We will be back this Wednesday evening at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time with exciting guests. Hope to see you then. Goodbye for now, and have a great, productive day.